The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting the latest vision news. Today's vision news is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. From ACB.org, announcing the call for nominations for the 2025 ADP Awards. When something is good, we tell our friends. When something is great, we tell the world. It's time to nominate the best audio description you've encountered for an ADP Award so we can tell the world what great AD sounds like. The ADP Awards are sponsored by the ACB's Audio Description Project to recognize achievement in audio description in 7 categories, including media, performing arts, museums, the public sector, and research and development. Nominations will be accepted from January 6 to April 7, 2025, and the winners will be announced in July at the ACB National Conference and Convention. Who can submit a nomination? Everyone. You are welcome to nominate yourself, your local theater or museum, or a well-known institution. Complete and submit the nomination form at https://forms.gle/capital G, number 8, capital W, X W U F, number 4, little k, capital K, Z R, capital P, 6, capital D, S, 7. Who is eligible for an award? Any person, organization, or institution that fits in one of the categories below and is involved in the research, development, production, design, creation, and/or delivery of great audio description is eligible. What are the criteria? The most important criterion is that the person or organization consistently develops, creates, and/or makes available excellent audio description. We encourage you to address the quality of the AD and other accessibility elements in your nomination. Bulletins. The AD script. Clear, concise, and vivid word choices that describe crucial visual elements without offering opinions, explanations, or interpretations. The AD voicing. Narration that enhances the experience by using a tone and energy level appropriate to the content. The AD sound. A smooth balance of dialogue, background noise, musical soundtrack, and audio description. Total access. How easy is it to access the audio description? Is the website and/or physical spaces accessible? Inclusion. To what extent are people on the blindness spectrum involved in the creation of audio description as writers, editors, sound engineers, or testers? What are the award categories? There are 7 categories. The same individual or organization may not be nominated in multiple categories. Media, performing arts, museums, visual art, visitor centers, public sector, government agencies, federal, state, or local, international, people and organizations working primarily outside the U.S. Dr. Margaret Fonstiel, P-F-A-N-S-T-I-E-H-L, Memorial Award for Audio Description, Research, and Development. Barry Levine Memorial Award for Career Achievement in Audio Description. Submit your nomination. Help us celebrate the people and organizations that are contributing significantly to the growth of high-quality audio description. Submit your nomination online at https://forms.gle/capital G, number 8, capital W, X W U F, number 4, little k, capital K, Z R, capital P, 6, capital D, S, 7, before April 7th, 2025. From magazine.med.miami.edu. A visionary team effort. Total Eye Transplants. University of Miami Medicine Magazines. Article by Fan Zhang, Z-H-A-N-G. A visionary team effort, total eye transplants. Surgery is quite close, but regenerative and immune response barriers remain. Researchers at Bascom Palmer Eye Institute and around the world have been developing new techniques to perform total eye transplants, an interdisciplinary moonshot project. At the Miller School alone, 16 faculty members, see full list below, are committed to making this happen, including experts in neurosurgery, biomedical engineering, transplant surgery, plastic surgery, immunology, and ophthalmology. In some respects, we are quite close to the final product, said Daniel Pelez, Ph.D., class of 11. That's P-E-L-A-E-Z. Research Associate Professor of Ophthalmology and Scientific Director of the Dr. Nasser Al-Rashid Vision Research Center. Bascom Palmer has been leading the way on their surgical techniques to harvest, transplant, and rehabilitate the eye. Dr. Pelez is co-principal investigator on the project with David Tse, TSE, MD, professor of ophthalmology and holder of the Dr. Nasser Ibrahim Al-Rashid Chair in Ophthalmology. There's still much work to do, but eventually this procedure will be a big win for many patients, including people who have lost an eye to cancer or trauma, and those with advanced macular degeneration or glaucoma. The immune response to eye transplantation is a significant unknown. While the eye's inside is considered immune-privileged, immune cells don't generally go there. The outside is not. Ocular immunologists are working to understand how the immune system responds to a transplanted eye. Perhaps the most significant barrier is connecting the optic nerve. Like the spinal cord, the nerve is part of the central nervous system. Connecting it to the nervous system is incredibly challenging. This will go beyond surgery, as researchers must develop new methods to regenerate and heal the reconnected nerve. We've been learning from our research on how to treat trauma to the optic nerve, where we can promote regeneration, Dr. Pelez said. We need to build on that research to develop more robust methods. We've also learned that the molecular mechanisms that drive internal heat generation in warm-blooded animals interfere with the regenerative processes in the central nervous system. In the last couple of studies, we've modulated those mechanisms and have improved the process, which can translate to spinal cord or any central nervous system regeneration. Bascom Palmer's physicians and scientists on the total eye transplant team include Felipe Medeiros, M-E-D-E-I-R-O-S, MD, PhD, Professor of Ophthalmology and Vice Chair of Research. He will provide expertise in data science and bioinformatics. Also on the team is Jean-Marie Parel, P-A-R-E-L, ETS-G, PhD, the Director of the Ophthalmic Biophysics Center, who has created more than 350 surgical instruments and clinical devices that have enhanced clinical optic care worldwide. Jianghua, that's spelled Wang, his nickname is Jay Wang, MD, PhD, an electrical and computer engineer, has developed a wide range of imaging modalities that study structural and functional alterations in the eyes. Additionally, Victor Perez, MD, an expert in ocular immunology, will evaluate the immune response to eye transplantation and devise immunomodulatory strategies for the success of the procedure. Vittorio Porciatti, P-O-R-C-I-A-T-T-I, Doctor of Science, Bascom Palmer's Director of Research, will bring his expertise as a neurologist, retinal electrophysiologist, and biomedical engineer. University of Miami collaborators on the project include Carolina Benjamin, MD, a neurosurgeon expert in microsurgical anatomical dissections with the skull base, who worked with Dr. Tse on the refinement of the novel surgical approach to eye transplantation. Ashutosh Agarwal, A-G-A-R-W-A-L, Ph.D., a biomedical engineer working in collaboration with Drs. Perel and Porciatti on an eye organ life support system, eye-ECMO, to maintain the donor eye alive and functional. And Robert Levy, Ph.D., a microbiology and immunology professor working alongside Dr. Perez on the immunological aspects of the project. Clifton McClenney and Louis Hatem, M.D., the senior director of operations and medical director of the Life Alliance Organ Recovery Program, respectively, will coordinate with other organ transplantation teams and facilities to develop harmonized guidelines for the successful recovery of human donor eyes. Alfred Tector, MD, and Rodrigo Viana, MD, PhD, from the Miami Transplant Institute, are specialists in the technical modifications necessary for organ transplantations. Finally, plastic surgeons Kyle Y. Xu, that's XU, MD, and Devinder Singh, SINGH, MD, are experts in microsurgery, specifically microvascular reconstruction. Daniel Pelez, PhD, University of Miami Medicine. From myamdteam.com, what does a person with geographic atrophy see? 6 sample images. Even if you've heard about common symptoms of age-related macular degeneration, AMD, understanding just how a person with the condition may experience these symptoms can be difficult. In the early stages of AMD, you may not have any changes in your vision. However, as this eye disease progresses, the symptoms can become more noticeable. Geographic atrophy is a late stage of AMD. People with geographic atrophy may develop many symptoms that affect their vision. If you have been diagnosed with AMD or want to understand what your loved one with AMD sees, this article will provide you with detailed descriptions and images. How does geographic atrophy progress? Geographic atrophy is an advanced form of dry AMD. Dry AMD is caused by yellow deposits called drusen that build up beneath the retina, the light-sensitive membrane that lines the inside of the back part of your eye. Drusen develop over time. As the deposits grow, they cause the cells in your macula, the central part of your retina, to deteriorate and die. Your macula controls your central vision, what you see when you look straight ahead. So AMD symptoms affect only this part of your vision. In geographic atrophy, larger areas of your macula begin to waste away and die, causing progressively worse symptoms. AMD can affect one or both eyes. You can also have a different type or severity of AMD in each eye. However, if you develop geographic atrophy in one eye, you're more likely to also develop it in the other eye. Typically, AMD doesn't affect your peripheral side vision. In the early stage of dry AMD, you may have no symptoms or notice only mild blurriness in your central vision. This means that what you see doesn't look as clear as it used to. In the intermediate stage of dry AMD, the area of blurriness can worsen and get bigger. For many people, central vision blurriness is still mild. The symptoms of early and intermediate dry AMD may go unnoticed because the healthy parts of your eye can mask your symptoms. If dry AMD progresses to geographic atrophy, your central vision loss becomes more apparent and can have a greater impact on your quality of life. Number 1, blurriness in your central vision. As dry AMD progresses to geographic atrophy, more and more retinal cells die. This results in an area of blurriness in your central vision that's larger and less clear than in other stages. If your central vision is blurry, it may be more difficult to see objects and scenes you're looking at directly. It may be harder to do activities you enjoy, such as watching television and reading. Number 2, blind spots in your vision. In addition to blurry vision, blind spots called scotomas, scotomas, may affect your central vision with geographic atrophy. Although scotomas may begin to develop in intermediate dry AMD, they can become bigger in geographic atrophy. Blind spots in your central vision can make it difficult to distinguish fine details. This can make it harder to read and to recognize the faces of your friends and loved ones. Blurriness and blind spots in your central vision can make it more difficult to take care of daily needs, such as cooking and cleaning. Number 3, loss of color vision. Photoreceptors, the cells responsible for telling your brain what colors you see, are primarily found in your macula. If geographic atrophy damages those photoreceptors, telling the difference between certain colors can become more difficult. Studies have found that people with AMD aren't able to distinguish between reds, greens, and blues as well as people without AMD. Although geographic atrophy doesn't affect the retinal cells responsible for peripheral vision, people with the condition still see only shades of black and gray in their peripheral vision. The loss of color vision and geographic atrophy isn't the same as color blindness. Color blindness is the result of a genetic abnormality in otherwise healthy retinal cells. In geographic atrophy, the loss of color vision is caused by the death of retinal cells. Many everyday tasks, such as cooking, driving, and choosing clothing, can become more difficult if you've lost your color vision. Your eye doctor can look for loss of color vision using a simple test in which you identify a shape made of different colored dots. If your color vision is fine, the shape is easy to spot. However, people who have trouble distinguishing colors due to geographic atrophy may have problems identifying the shapes. Number four, areas of your vision that appear curvy or wavy. If you have geographic atrophy, you may notice that parts of your central vision seem to be distorted. This can be more obvious when you're looking at objects that you know have straight edges, like window blinds, but they look curved or wavy instead. Since dry AMD symptoms usually develop gradually, your eye doctor may recommend that you use an Amsler grid to check your vision every day. This is a square with a grid pattern and a dot in the middle that helps you track vision changes that may not be obvious. If straight lines on an Amsler grid appear curved or wavy, you should call your eye doctor right away. When this symptom appears suddenly, it may signal that geographic atrophy is progressing to a type of advanced AMD called wet AMD. Wet AMD can cause faster vision loss due to the growth of abnormal blood vessels beneath your macula. Using the Amsler grid daily can help you identify this symptom early so you can get appropriate treatment. Coping with vision changes from geographic atrophy. Vision changes caused by geographic atrophy can affect your quality of life by making it more difficult to take care of yourself, participate in activities you enjoy, and interact with people around you. You may also find it difficult to see while driving or even walking across the street, which can leave you feeling anxious. However, you can take steps to help manage the symptoms of geographic atrophy. Using brighter lights or a magnifying glass can help you with certain tasks and activities like reading. Visual aids, such as an app on your phone or tablet, may help you better recognize faces and colors. You can talk to a low vision specialist to learn about more ways to cope with vision loss caused by geographic atrophy. Talk to your eye doctor to learn more about your risk of progressing to geographic atrophy and the best treatment plan for your AMD. Find your team. On My AMD Team, the social network for people with age-related macular degeneration and their loved ones, members can come together to ask questions, give advice, and share their stories with those who understand. Are you or a family member living with geographic atrophy? Do you have questions about what people with geographic atrophy see? Share them in a comment or on your activities page. From FightingBlindness.org, staying true to music, family, and advocacy. Andrew Barkan, Barkan, and Polly Hall, the dynamic duo behind the Grammy-nominated family music act Andrew and Polly, have been making waves in the world of children's music. Their latest album, that's A with a bunch of H's and an exclamation point, has earned them a nomination for Best Children's Album. But their journey is about much more than music. Andrew, diagnosed with Stargardt disease after a fall in third grade, has never let his disability define him. Growing up with a passion for music, he taught himself piano, participated in musical theater, and joined a cappella groups in high school. His academic journey took him to the Thatcher School in Ojai, Amherst College, and NYU for graduate school. Today, Andrew and Polly live in Santa Monica, California, where they continue to inspire through their music and advocacy. His siblings, Phoebe and Will, also have Stargardt disease, and their entire family has been actively involved in genetic testing and research to better understand the condition. As the oldest sibling, I would run into challenges and try to help my younger siblings through them, Andrew recalls. The sense of responsibility and support has been a constant in his life, leading to the creation of the podcast Disability Happy Hour, where Andrew, Phoebe, and Will share their experiences and advocate for a more inclusive world. Andrew and Polly are fierce advocates for high-quality, diverse media for children. As the parents of three young children, the married couple understands the importance of representation and inclusivity education. We think so hard about how to talk about disabilities now, because we have children, Polly explains. Their music, which spans genres from pop and folk to hip-hop, reflects their commitment to celebrating the complexities and joys of family life. Their journey into children's music began almost 15 years ago, after working in a studio for film and television for many years. Their credits include music for Apple TV+, Netflix, Nickelodeon, Sony, Disney, Sesame Workshop, and brands such as Google, Facebook, Nike, GE, Levi's, IKEA, Toyota, and Sprint. They then found a new community and joy in making music for children, leading to the creation of their podcast, Ear Snacks. This platform allows children to hear their own voices and learn from each other, fostering a sense of connection and growth. Kids are fun and smart, and families deserve music that reflects that, says Andrew. We want our music to honor the awesomeness and overwhelming chaos of being a family, Polly adds. Every song has so many layers for the child today, next year, for when they're in high school. They should be able to come back to it and say, there's still something there for me now, and layers for the parents, obviously. Andrew's advocacy extends beyond music. He is currently participating in a clinical trial at UCLA's Jules Stein Eye Institute, where researchers are working to regrow retinal cells. This groundbreaking work offers hope and underscores Andrew's commitment to advancing research and treatment for blinding diseases. Blindness is not my disability. What makes me disabled is the world around me and society's design, which creates barriers to accessing the world, Andrew says. This perspective drives his advocacy for a more inclusive society where everyone has the opportunity to thrive. Polly, too, has been a steadfast supporter and ally. In supporting someone with a disability, I'm sure that I have tried to do things that I now think, why did I do that? She reflects. So much of our identity work and open dialogue about disabilities isn't something we had when we were growing up. We want to have anti-ableism as part of the work you can do as an individual and then spread that beyond the community. To be even more connected with the disability community, Andrew has become a member of RAMPD, Recording Artists and Music Professionals with Disabilities. At the Grammys last year, he received a glam white cane from Lachi, L-A-C-H-I, which he initially hesitated to use. However, embracing the white cane has been liberating, providing him with newfound independence and confidence. Using his white cane, Andrew was able to ask someone at a hotel what was on the buffet bar without them looking at him like he should know what's there, Polly recalls. This small act of independence highlights the importance of accessibility and the impact of supportive communities. Their advice to others facing similar challenges is simple yet profound. Connect with others, find resources, and share your stories. We learn so much from shared stories, from hearing and sharing, Andrew emphasizes. Their music advocacy and personal experiences offer hope and inspiration for families navigating the complexities of disabilities. Andrew and Polly's story is a powerful reminder of the strength found in community, the importance of representation, and the transformative power of music. Their musical journey inspires and uplifts, bringing light to a more inclusive and compassionate world. From DisabilityRightsNC.org, December 17, 2024, plaintiff's response and comments on defendant's December 5, 2024, Samantha R. reporting status update. Below are plaintiff's comments on defendant's December 5th Samantha R. reporting status update for the period April 1, 2024 to June 30, 2024, December 5 report or quarterly report. A report for this period was due October 15, 2024, but not submitted. Defendants provided a report on November 1, 2024, and plaintiffs responded by letter on November 8, 2024. Those documents are attached. The November 8th letter was primarily focused on the terms of the reporting required by the consent order and the lack of data originally provided. Those comments are incorporated here rather than being repeated. Summary of comments. The December 5 report is missing core information needed to assess compliance and to ensure that gaps in services are remedied through future compliance or orders. Specifically, the December 5 report from defendants raises the following concerns. Bullets. Defendants have failed to gather core data regarding LME/MCO transition and diversion activities, making it difficult to determine whether defendants are on track to meet the transitions and diversions benchmark. Quarterly report, pages 4 to 5. Defendants have failed to demonstrate compliance with the benchmark requiring a utilization rate of at least 82% for DSPs providing a core innovations waiver service. No data was reported or projected regarding this benchmark. Quarterly report, page 8. Although incomplete information makes it difficult to determine, defendants do not appear to have met the benchmark requiring transition from B subsection 3 services to 1915 section I services for those on the innovations waiver list waiting list by June 2024. Quarterly report, page 7. Defendants are not tracking the unmet needs of those on the innovations waiver waiting list who are receiving 1915 section I services but still have unmet needs. Quarterly report, page 6. No data was provided for IV.1.H, which is qualitative information about successful and unsuccessful transitions. Background. The consent order has two primary features. The first is a set of benchmarks for progress toward ensuring that individuals currently living in settings defined as institutional are provided an avenue for transitioning to community-based services and ensuring that defendants are actively and effectively building service capacity in the community. The second is a set of reporting requirements designed to provide the parties and the court with information necessary to measure the continued unmet needs in the I/DD community for purposes of determining progress toward compliance with Olmstead's principles and or developing future remedial orders and benchmarks. The consent order requires defendants to produce quarterly reports over a period of approximately 2 years that contain information to assess defendants' compliance with the consent order, as well as data to guide further remedies. The December 5th report covers the period from April 2024 to June 2024 and was due on October 15, 2024. Defendants contested the timing requirement regarding the initial report as reflected in the November 1, 2024 report and plaintiff's response. However, the parties agree that the next report from defendants was due January 15, 2025. There is a whole lot more to this article, but I'm running low on time. Skipping to the end of page 4, a particular point of emphasis from plaintiffs in the development of the consent order was oversight of LME/MCOs and defendants' ultimately responsibility for the compliance or noncompliance of contractors. The state committed in the form of a consent order to the collection of specific data. The failure to ensure production of the data falls on defendants as it relates to compliance with the consent order. In summary, the December 5th report indicates that defendants have not met initial benchmarks, although the gaps in data make it unclear in some instances. In addition, the December 5th report raises concerns about data collection, which is a primary purpose of the 2-year consent order. Plaintiffs believe that the next quarterly report, due January 15, 2025, provides important insight regarding defendants' capacity to meet the terms. We have run out of time for this week's Vision News. Today's episode is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.